I don't like this business of preaching to fans.
Calm down, Greg. It's soccer. It's soccer.
You know anything else about soccer?
Not much. All I know is I got a lot of balls.
You know, it doesn't matter if you're in the stadium watching a game on TV. It's just the guy's not good enough. The guy is just not good enough.
Simon, I don't know if you're big into New Year's resolutions, but, you know, wondering if maybe you pledged to come out of your shell a little bit in 2015.
Kind of pisses me off, to be honest.
That's why he's here!
David Goss and Simon Borg here on Extra Time Radio on Sirius XM Channel 94 and MLSsoccer.com.
Back in the saddle.
David, damn those llamas.
Yeah.
Because that's all anyone's talking about right now. And the Montreal Impact and what they did in Mexico is now going to be out of the news cycle for a little bit as people discuss the llamas and watch that
was
video.
The number one trending topic in the United States this afternoon.
Was llamas. And
yeah,
I'm sure
on
in
Thursday
Canada as
afternoon.
Well. It's got to be in Canada as well.
I don't know. But all I looked at was the United States.
Everyone latching onto that video, if you haven't seen it, of llamas running around Arizona.
And elusive, to say the least.
Do we know? It was two of them. Do we know if they escaped the zoo or they were just
I don't
came
know
out
the full
of nowhere?
Story. I don't know the full story. I don't know who they were trained by. I don't know where they're from. I don't know what their plans are.
Ooh, you think they were trained?
I don't think that this is a coincidence.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Llama conspiracy
they're
from
too, they were too effective.
We have an interesting show for you today. We're going to go over what we saw in Champions League. It's the first official competition, and we're going to sink our teeth into it. We've been waiting for that first official game for a long time. We got it. Montreal against Pachuca, and they gave us a good show. A lot to discuss there. We're going to discuss everything going around MLS. Then in segment two, we're going to have an interesting conversation with a professor. His name is Professor Brett Myers.
And can I just say...
Yeah.
Andrew Wiebe gets off the show for 1 week, and we have
we're
two
get into
professors.
That. There you go. Very good point.
So the intelligence level has raised since Andrew has gone to his little intelligence conference.
Has raised or risen?
What language? I'm gooder at
maybe
English.
Maybe it hasn't risen that much. Andrew Wiebe is not here because he is going to moderate the soccer part of the MIT Sloan statistical, what's it called? What's the official name?
The MIT Sloan Sports and Analytics Conference.
What are you doing? You have to pay attention to the show. What are you doing there?
Someone just sent me the video of in the nature of Montreal's success. I'm in love with Rio Coker. Have you seen this video?
No,
it's a spoof on a famous YouTube video that's going around right now. And Rio Coker's name fit perfectly into it. And so I believe it's the front office at Montreal, and they're doing this rap video about Rio Coker.
Why don't we play that audio then in the break between segments here? So we're going to have Professor Brett Myers. He is an associate professor at the Villanova School of Business. And it's an interesting discussion because IFAB, they are the board that controls soccer rules across the world. And they meet every so often. They discuss the rules. And there is an interesting proposal that they're going to be considering about a fourth substitution. So we'll get into that. But first, we start with the Montreal Impact.
Yeah.
And this was as unexpected a result as you could have thought of. On Tuesday night, they go into Pachuca. Now, they spent, 12 days in Mexico?
Yeah.
So from a preparation standpoint, they thought it out.
They were just abusing the Cruz Azul second team whenever they felt like it in practice.
And they come out 2-2 from that first leg, two big away goals against Pachuca. A Pachuca team that in recent matches had been, they were on an upsurge in Liga MX. I was shocked. I was shocked that they played, that Montreal played as well as they did. Credit to Frank Klopas and that crew.
And they come into the game and you say, you know, if they score first, maybe they have a chance. And if they can hold them off in the first half. And they did all of those things. Dili Duca took a chance. He challenged his man. He got into the top of the box. He gets a deflected goal. We saw it in the Arsenal game in Champions League yesterday. They all count. It stems the tide. And it put Pachuca, I think, in a little bit of a panic mode. And we had Eddie Mendez on this show to talk about them, who's seen them a lot. And he said they struggle to finish. That they create, but they struggle to finish. And now
I don't even think they created that much. I thought Montreal was so well organized, and the defenders were on top of players as soon as they got the ball. And how about Laurent Simon coming out with easily, I think, as Dili Duca scored the two goals.
Yeah.
But Laurent Simon came out with the ravest of reviews of anyone
Although,
on that Montreal team.
unapologetic that on that second free kick, okay, the first free kick from far out, he decides he's going to blast it on goal and it goes veering off to the right. But the second one, gotten your one chance.
Laurent Simon, a center back, was taking free kicks and they were, I think the second one was worse than the first, you're saying.
The second one was, first of all, farther out. Second of all, late in the game where it's like, all right, maybe, you know, clip this to the corner, have Justin Mapp put some pressure on, who looked phenomenal and was the only guy who looked like he had fresh legs towards the end of the game. Everyone else was dead.
But I was surprised how Montreal came out running as much as they did. I was screaming at the TV saying, do they know what they're doing? Dili Duka was hustling so much in that first half. I thought they were going to be gassed by halftime.
Well, in the 60th minute, they were. Rio Coker definitely was.
He looked gassed the whole game.
Well, I thought he looked okay at times in the first half. Him and Donadel, I thought, were a step late at times in the center midfield to close.
I agree. But I thought that was the weakest part of the Montreal team.
And I think also part of that was a lot of the moments where they were late was when Duka and Mapp had kind of pushed out. And so the midfield was spread a little bit more. But besides that, I think they did everything right. I didn't think Kamara was going to make it through the game. Coming on as a second-half sub to play right back, he was going in on every tackle. And he was late on a lot of them.
But that's your usual Kamara game.
He had a great CONCACAF moment, though, when he went down to the ground when there wasn't really much contact on a push to try and get a card the other way. And it was right in front of the bench, and it was right in front of the fourth official, and it had that nice little taste of CONCACAF.
Now, things were going great for Montreal. They were 2-0 up. Again, Duka getting both goals. And then there comes a point then where Pachuca get their goals, and then you start seeing the refereeing go in the direction where you're scratching your head at some of the decisions, and then you had the two goals. Now, for as much as we're praising Laurent Simon, whose fault is it on that second goal? Is their fault? A ball comes into the box across from the left, and goalkeeper Evan Bush goes out for it, and Simon is coming in, and he's diving for it. Ball pops loose.
Yeah, it's tough because I don't know if Pachuca scores if Bush doesn't touch it. Because it's going to the far post for a tap-in, but it looked like, I don't remember who, was there for support there to potentially clear
it. Bush should have had that ball.
Maybe, but I think his touch caught Simon off. It caught everyone off guard. And it even caught the Pachuca striker off guard. I mean, all he did was just put his body there, and it went in. It was really unfortunate the way it bounced around. But I'm interested you mentioned the referees, and maybe it's because I'm like numb to it at this point. We got a lot of tweets from fans who were complaining about the officiating.
In the second half, reason.
Yeah, I didn't notice it.
The second half, it was, there were fouls that were being whistled that, you know, that maybe in games where the ref is having a better game, you're not whistling those. You're not calling those fouls. So 50-50 kind of duels.
Because he was losing control, you think?
No, I don't know what it is. It's just the decisions left you scratching your head. I mean, I can't speak for the ref. But
okay, so here's the other talking point coming out of this game, which we were hearing. One was the officiating. The other one we were getting a lot of tweets about was we were up 2 and we gave up 2, which is a tough pill to swallow. If we walked into this room last week and said you get 2 away goals in Mexico, I think everyone would take
that. Everyone would take it, for sure.
But then you're up 2-0, and it's tough to walk away with that.
Sure, but although I actually come away feeling that the Montreal Impact were not their morale was not hurt that hard by the fact that they give up 2 goals.
You don't think they were deflated?
I didn't think at all.
Yeah,
and that's to me a sign of a strong team, and I think they showed. There were many parts of that game where you saw them running for each other. You saw them hustling as hard as they did. I like the feel of this team, which is not what we expected. They were the worst team in MLS
last year.
And when you have a rebuilding job like Klopp has had during the offseason, you did the stat. How many players started in this game?
I'm fairly certain one of the starting 11 was in the team when they started last season. Everyone else in that starting 11 was a new player.
We're talking Evan Bush, right? Then Evan Bush, the
goalkeeper. No, Matt. Because Bush didn't start last year.
Right.
It was Perkins. Rio Coker was captain in his debut for the team, which is, I mean, not very – that doesn't happen very often, as much as we've talked about captains over the last few weeks. And it was a lot of new pieces that were put together. Of course, Piatti played.
Piatti's fantastic. He's such a fantastic player.
And there were a few moments people felt like he was being selfish.
Selfish, right.
But he has that quality that a lot of people don't. And a lot of times when teams, MLS teams go down to Mexico, the player that they say is the guy who's going to be able to hold the ball when they're under pressure doesn't. And that's the failure. And I thought he did.
He did. You're absolutely right.
So I thought, well, in those moments, but he thinks he can make something special happen. But I want to bring up this other talking point, which is that we were getting a lot, which was there was no Canadians that appeared for Montreal.
Yeah, and I followed some of the Mexican coverage following the result. And by the way, the Mexicans are in despair. They're like, well, you know, I was watching one program on Fox Deportes, and they were talking about how, well, is Mexico, you know, maybe not Mexican League, Mexican League teams, not really able to get out, you know, is CONCACAF now too competitive for the Mexican teams?
Yeah.
And so they're you know, flailing in despair in Mexico, questioning whether, is it a question of the other leagues
improving,
or is it that they're regressing?
And I'm sure there was a little bit of relief from that after, on Wednesday night, Club America defeated Saprissa on the road. Tough away game, 3-0.
And you saw the quality difference there.
Yeah.
So Saprissa had their fair share of looks, and their forwards just couldn't find the net. And they were really good looks. But America, they had a few chances toward the end, and they scored on each one of those. They were very efficient towards the end there. So I think the other side of this is Pachuca didn't have a full team. Like, they started most of their players, their regulars. But they were not – they did not concern me at any point in the game. They weren't creating enough soccer, I felt. They were stymied by Montreal, I felt, for large stretches of that game.
The only question for me was when I saw Montreal lose their energy. You could see it happen at the 60th minute. Rio Coker was very obvious, and it was being talked about on the broadcast the whole time. But I thought Duca lost a step as well. Donadel got subbed out. But you could see them lose that energy. And the question was, when they gave up the goal – and with the energy level, was it all going to fall apart for them? Was it going to become Mexico?
You didn't see any signs that was about to happen.
Yeah, that was the worry, but you're right. It never happened, and that's credit to them, and they played comfortably. They didn't look like a team that was playing together for the first time.
Correct.
That's absolutely true. So whatever it was that Montreal chose to do going into this game, which I hope DC United also chose, or in some way is going to be able to do that, whatever it is that they did, they need to share that, because other teams need to start focusing on these games the way they do. And it's awesome because, excuse me for using the word awesome, but because Montreal has a history with this competition where they've had such great games at Olympic Stadium, and now coming off this result, you really hope that the crowd comes out and really pushes them in the next leg.
Before we talk just briefly about that second leg, we're not going to delve into DC United and their match at Alajuelense, because by the time you listen to this podcast and by the time you listen to the show on Sirius XM Channel 94, that game will be done and dusted. So we won't preview that. We'll talk about it more next week. But going back to the Montreal game, now there's questions about who in the second leg do you start Dominic Oduro again up top, or do you go with a Jack McInerney?
Yeah.
What's your sense?
I would go with the McInerney, because I think you needed Oduro in this game, because you needed someone who could pressure up top by himself when he had to, and someone who could chase long balls when he had to.
But what changes in the second leg? To me, Montreal has to maintain the same tactics they did in that first game.
But I think you still have more possession, because you're at home now.
No, you're not at the altitude.
You've gotten a game under your legs because you're coming out of preseason, so you should be a little bit fitter, a little bit sharper. You've got your crowd behind you rather than their crowd against you. And you have the away goals to sit on, but you still need to at least draw, unless you get to 2-2 and worse, and then win. You still need to get a result. You can't lose this game 1-0 and sit back and lose 1-0.
Agreed.
And you don't want to have to pressure after you've already given up a goal. So at some way, I think you have to open up a little bit.
But when you look at the team that they put out on the field, those players are better in transition. If you're talking about Dili Duca, Justin Mapp, Ignacio Piatti, and Dominic Oduro, that front four, they want to operate in space. They want to operate in transition, on the counter.
But so much of the creative play wasn't Oduro. It was Duca, Mapp, or Piatti creating something either out of nothing, off the dribble, between each other, with some sort of connection. You need someone on the end of it that will finish it. And I don't know if Dom Oduro is that guy. We've seen him in MLS. We know what he is. He can score 12 goals in his season, but they're going to come at a low percentage of converting his chances. So do you want to take that risk? Do you need to? At the same time, what a great sub to bring those legs on late in a game when another team's tired.
So the Montreal, that second leg is going to be on Tuesday, March 3rd, 8 p.m. Eastern from the Big O, Fox Sports 2, that second leg against Pachuca. Now, they're in Montreal. They've arrived, and they'll have that game to help them prepare for their opening game of the MLS season, where they're going to have to go to D.C. on Saturday, March 7th, 3 p.m. Eastern RDS. So the two teams involved in Champions League face off in the opening weekend. But I want to set our sights on the very first game of the MLS season. That's on March 6th, the Friday, 10 p.m. Eastern on Unimas. And that's L.A. Chicago, because we're getting news that David Akam, the Ghanaian international who was with Ghana at the African Nations Cup.
Designated player,
big signing for them in the offseason. He has picked up a groin injury, and there is a chance it could keep him out of the match at StubHub Center. Too early to tell yet how big of a player he's going to be for them. You assume because of his DP status, he is going to be a big player, someone they're counting on. But that's already a big blow on the road. When you have a guy as speedy as David Akam, and we saw those spurts in the African Nations Cup, that's got to hurt. I mean, Chicago going into L.A.
And it just hurts because you're a team that was upset with the way last season went, made heavy changes. And from what we saw from Portland last year, you need as much time early in the season to get everyone going together, because you don't want to have to try and get uphill late in the season. And for Chicago, they were able to get results last year, but obviously they were not able to get wins. And Akam was supposed to be a major part of creating goals, along with Maloney and Igboanike.
Here's what Frank Yallop, the Firehead coach, had to say about the injury. He's got a slight strain in the first 5 days. Determine how bad it is. We're on day two or three right now, and this is as of Thursday. So we'll know more in a couple of days to see what the extent is. He's had an MRI. There's a slight something there. If he's a quick healer, which hopefully he is, he could be available for the season opener, but there's no chance we're going to risk him just for one match. So I think you can get some indication there of how they're feeling about Akam's situation.
But the piece of MLS news from this week that caught my eye was Kaká was named captain officially by Orlando City.
Why did that catch your eye?
Because we had talked about the big acquisition becoming captain. Now, we had said expansion's different, but NYCFC is a new team. Orlando has existed, and I think you figured it would be Kaká, but they have players. They have a player in Okugo who has played in this league, and a guy in Tally Hall that's played in this league, and a guy in Kevin Molino that's played for that team. So there felt like there might have been other options that you could have gone with. But in the end, I guess that's not the case.
Who's the vice captain on Orlando?
I don't know if they said that yet.
Who would I make it?
I'd probably make it Okugo or Molina, a guy who has more association. I don't think Aurelien Collin is exactly the guy that you want as your captain. He's the guy that the captain has to hold back at times. But I think I would go with one of those two. I know Okugo's young, so is Molino. But those are guys that have experience in the league and experience in Orlando.
Not to be outdone, the other expansion team this week, NYCFC, announcing that they have 14,000 season tickets now. So that's a strong start for that team.
Simon, are you going to go out as a fan? You have a team on your beloved subway system.
Do I look like I have time to be a fan? With all the weekends we log in. By the way, you're here most weekends as well.
Yes.
So when are you going to be a fan?
I don't know, but now there's two teams. So now I have double the opportunity to get to go to games that are very close and local.
Well, NYCFC has come up because, look, we look at NYCFC coming here, especially those of us who live in New York, and we say, okay, this is an immediate rivalry with New York Red Bulls. And by the way, let's go to results for a second here.
Yeah.
New York City FC, after that first game that we may have jinxed them here on this show, they lost, what, three straight, right?
Yeah.
And what do you think of them? Did you catch any of their game?
No, I didn't watch the game yesterday.
Against the Houston Dynamo. Yeah. They lost 2-1. Jason Christ was still happy with how his team pushed forward. And they're going to be a team that, similar to what we're used to from Real Salt Lake, Jason Christ's former club, in the past, they're going to push the game and take it to
I
the other team.
I said when you went Barcelona-esque on one direction, and now you're going to go
off. No, you
put
that in my...
And now you're going to go off the deep end in the other direction. It's preseason. You're never going to know everything. You're never going to know exactly what you're going to get, but NYCFC did make a little bit of noise here because there was a poll of what's the number one rivalry an MLS, and you're talking...
Well, no, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
So I think all of us assume that that Red Bull New York City FC rivalry mm-hmm. is going to quickly get up there among the
but is going
fiercest.
To. Yeah, it's not there yet because they've never played.
But according to the poll, and that's what you were referencing, we have a rivalry survey that's happening
yeah,
among MLS fans.
So current standings,
yeah.
The number one rivalry in MLS is what, Simon? What do you
Seattle,
think?
Seattle-Portland. Everyone
Seattle-Portland.
Says, yeah, everyone knows
the number two rivalry, as the votes are right now, is the LA Galaxy and the Seattle Sounders. The number three rivalry is the classic time-honored one, the New York Red Bulls and DC United. The number four rivalry is the California Classic, San Jose.
Clásico.
Clásico.
All right.
San Jose, LA. Number four is the Rocky Mountain Cup, Colorado RSL. Now, we do have to say the most votes of any state that has voted in this is from Washington State.
Okay.
So not...
It might explain why LA Seattle is so high up.
Yeah.
Now, last year's run for the Supporters Shield and for MLS Cup between those two teams, I think, contributes to that. But LA Seattle, second in there. What do you think it's going to take for NYCFC and the Red Bulls?
I think it takes characters.
To supersede New York, D.C. Because New York, D.C. is third
yeah.
in the list.
And also,
do you think Red Bull fans, what is it going to take for them to feel the rivalry with NYCFC more than DC?
It's going to take a lot of losses in big games. That's what it took with DC. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take playoff
so
losses.
So you're saying there's no chance that NYCFC Red Bulls surpasses New York Red Bulls versus DC?
Well, I'll give it to you like this. When you look at other sports, there's a rivalry between New York teams, but it's not as big as the rivalry with the cities around here. Yankees and Red Sox and Jets and Patriots are bigger than Jets and Giants and Yankees and Mets. But there is a rivalry there, and there always will be, because you will have kids that go, this is from personal experience, that go to school together, and one will rag on the other at all moments when one team is doing better than the other, and that's what creates a rivalry. But you need, we've talked about it before, is it cities or is it teams? You need villains, you need characters, you need moments. You need those things to spark the rivalry. I don't think it's going to take long, but you need to get them on the field, and you need that first moment when someone slaps someone off the ball, or some, you know, some coach, whatever, comes on the field and pushes some player, and
whoa,
that's where it starts.
Where are you going? This is what it takes to have a rivalry with you, David.
That's why we don't have a rivalry. It's just love with you, Simon.
We'd love to know what you think of the MLS rivalry
and
rankings.
And you can still vote on MLSsoccer.com, of course. And please do if you think that those rankings are wrong.
I think Seattle-Portland's going to win. We know. So I guess the question really is for everyone, what is the second best rivalry in MLS? Is it, in fact, LA-Seattle, the way the polls show right now? Is it another rivalry? Let us know. That's you can get to us at Extra Time Radio on Twitter. ExtraTime@MLSsoccer.com is the email address. And we're going to come up now in segment two, and we're going to talk about the proposal for a fourth substitutions. We're going to get into some international soccer. There's some Julian Green news that we also want to discuss.
You would love to discuss
that coming up in segment two right after the break.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime@mlssoccer.com or tweet at Extra Time Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
This is Merritt Paulson with the Portland Timbers, and you are listening to Extra Time Radio.
I'm in love with real coke. I'm in love with real coke. We got it, now it's over.
That's the spoof video that David was talking about.
It's in love with Rio Coker is what it called, if you'd like to search it yourself.
Is it on YouTube? Yeah.
Yeah.
The but you promised that the visuals are a lot more entertaining.
Well,
than
it's pretty funny. It's
lyrics.
It's a bunch of guys rolling around in their office imitating the video Coco, which has over 80 million plays on YouTube.
The
original
video,
not the Montreal version. But I can tell you this, a lot of people are in love with Real Coker right now.
Look, that's one spoof that I guess is they're going to be writing a little bit here. One spoof that didn't work on this week, and we mention it because it involves a U.S.-based company, Dunkin' Donuts, and they tried to remake a logo, and specifically here Liverpool FC's logo.
And the purpose of the campaign was to say, hey, show us what your remade logo would be like for you, and maybe we'll make it for you.
A remade logo, like, but it has to involve a soccer logo?
Yeah, I think so, but I don't think it had to be Liverpool.
But there is a relationship from
what
I understand,
they are
right?
They are a corporate partner.
They're a corporate partner of Liverpool, Dunkin' Donuts is, and the owners of Liverpool FC is Boston-based Fenway Sports Group, and Dunkin' Donuts, obviously a staple of the New England area. But if they, as a corporation, are going to be going the route of doing this spoof and remaking the logo, and you're going to get into why it's caused so much controversy, you got to figure that they would have checked with Liverpool before this happened. What happened after?
So if you picture the Liverpool logo in your head, which is the bird in the middle with the gates and the You'll Never Walk Alone, and on the sides is two flames. Those two flames are an everlasting flame for the fans that passed away at the Hillsborough tragedy, and they replaced all of that. And for the two flames, they put two cups of Dunkin' Donuts coffee because it fits perfectly size-wise there. And I don't think people were happy about that, Simon.
No, they weren't. So we're seeing a lot of the backlash now from Liverpool fans, who obviously are sensitive to those flames being made into a corporate corporate spoof here. So they did not take well to it. So Dunkin' Donuts doing some damage control on this day. Moving on, someone else who might be wanting to do some damage control. He's done it in the past. He knows how to do damage control, and that's Julian Green. I know your personal, one of your favorite U.S. players right now, David, national team players, you and a whole army out there that I've yet to hear from since all this news has been coming down about his stay at Hamburg. And the news coming out of Germany, local papers say that the loan fee agreed upon between Bayern Munich and Hamburg
has a clause that it increases every time Julian Green does not dress in the 18. Not that he does play, does not. No. So for them to make the decision that he's not going to dress doesn't just
it's costing mean them money.
That they don't think he's good enough to play in the 18. They don't think he's – they think he's so far from that point that they're willing to pay extra money to not dress him.
And obviously this is a – it's a great deal for Bayern Munich because according to reports, they believe that he is not ready. He's far from being ready to join their first team.
Yeah.
So they're getting – I think the estimation I saw was around $500,000 –
Euros.
Is it Euros? Yeah. To have him at Hamburg and that fee is going up. And what do you make of it?
I think, first of all, it's a smart move for Bayern because you want him to get playing time. Yeah. So it's your incentive. But
I did not know, by the way, that those are the kind of clauses that go into loan deals.
Yeah, I've never seen that before either. But it
makes sense.
It's a very bad look on Julian Green if that's how far they think he is from not starting, but just being in the 18. Potentially being, I mean, you see teams put 16 and 17-year-olds in their 18 just to potentially give them 2 minutes of a run out in the 89th minute.
So here's my question. U.S. national team matches in March.
Yeah, I think he gets called in.
Get out of here.
Breck Shea got called in when he was never going to play for Stoke. Jurgen Klinsmann likes to call guys in who he thinks, first of all, need the minutes because he thinks they're good enough. And also for him to help them angle to getting a club, for them to show themselves with the U.S. national team. I think he definitely gets called in by Klinsmann unless there's some sort of situation where he's playing more or he's hurt.
Here's where the Breck Shea comparison to me doesn't work. Breck Shea was at Stoke,
mm-hmm.
and he just wasn't breaking into the lineup.
Yeah.
It wasn't that he was not that level of player. Like, it's not that he couldn't play in the Premier League.
Well,
it's just that he wasn't breaking through that lineup.
There's no way
lineup
to prove that, though. He's never played for another EPL team, and he's not in the near future.
Whenever he was loaned out
to the second
teams
division
that he was loaned out, it happened to be in the championship.
So he proved he could play in the championship, not in the Premier League.
But he was a starter.
When he went to Birmingham for a month and a half at a time.
Right, but my point being that he was getting games. It wasn't a question of him not being ready to play. So I don't know that if Hamburg had a second division team, I'm not sure Julian Green would get time with them either.
Well, they've tried to put him on their U23s.
Which plays in what division?
Lower than the second division.
Thank you.
But that doesn't
mean... So how can you compare Julian Green to Breck Shea?
Because I think Klinsmann thinks he's good enough to at least play for a team. And the thought is if I put him on the national team and he gets an area where he can show himself, another team will try and get him from Bayern. And that's a team that he can play with.
What's interesting here is that I think Jurgen Klinsmann is going to have to answer this question eventually. You put your faith in a player who can't even get time with one of the worst teams in the Bundesliga. And I think you have to answer. You have to answer that at some point. What did you see that clearly two teams are not seeing, both Bayern Munich and Hamburg?
Well, once again, and I know that you've thrown me on the other side of this debate with you, but I once again feel that you've judged too harshly a player who is very young and has yet
you
to prove
himself. You can tell the personality. You think you can tell.
But one guy who we both love and we were so happy to see get a loan move and get some goals was Bobby Wood. And unfortunately, he has gotten injured and is out for 2 months. So we're going to keep everyone up on the Bobby Wood reports, though, because we were so excited that he finally got to play for the Swedish
We were more excited about the team name.
But I was very excited to see him get out of his situation and get some playing time, and he got hurt, and that's unfortunate to hear.
We can all agree that all our best wishes go to Bobby Wood, but what we might not agree on is this proposal that's going in front of IFAB, the board that governs rules in soccer. And they, among the considerations they'll be debating and potentially could approve, is the use of a fourth sub in extra time.
Yeah.
I left scratching my head as to why would you introduce a fourth sub and only use the sub in extra time.
Well,
extra time should mean, to me, should be an extension of that game. It should not have rules unto itself.
Well, one of the things that you see, which is a major issue, is as games go towards extra time, coaches hold on to their third substitution in a worry.
So
you run these guys into the ground. You lower the quality of play. You endanger players, because you have to keep them out there and they have to play more than they probably should at times. And so I understand your sentiment. The way I would fix it, the way I see it, because one of the major reasons for holding on to that sub is in case someone gets hurt, I would have four substitutions, three for field players and one for the goalkeeper, so that you don't have to get in a situation where I don't want to make my last sub in case something happens to my goalie.
My thing is, why is this even like a hard topic for these decision makers to...
Because they're against a lot of people are
against
struggle
change.
With change. I mean, I know, these are like, people that.
What could the drawback possibly be?
Just that. When does it end? There was no substitutions to start in the game of soccer. A lot of people will know about 1954 final. Puskas started when he wasn't fit, even though he scores, and they lose that game, and that was a big debate. Then you had teams hacking players, and once like a player like Pele went out injured against Uruguay, you didn't have a substitution. Then you had substitutions. Then you had finally, now you get to three.
Okay,
when you move it to four, the question is, at what point does it become, now you have 11 subs?
No,
that's
a big jump from 4 to 11. I'm not saying go to 11. I'm saying have a fourth one. It makes sense. We've watched enough soccer to know where, you know, a fourth actually could make the game more interesting, more entertaining. And I'm not saying go from 4 to 11. Just go for it, but don't do it just for extra time.
I think
if they do that, they've not really changed anything.
I think this is a step to go about. I think this is a first step to eventually getting to, which is what you want, is a fourth substitution just throughout
this
the game.
Change is so slow in soccer. But we'll speak to someone who has a lot of insight when it comes to substitutions in the professional in the game, and that is Professor Brett Myers, who is, in addition to being an analytics consultant for Toronto FC, is also an assistant professor of operations and management at the Villanova School of Business. He has studied the substitution in soccer, and we'll get into it a little bit with him. Brett, thank you for joining us here on Extra Time Radio.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
First off, tell us about your history in soccer analytics. How long have you been involved, and when did you do this study about subs?
Well, yeah, it really began with the study on substitutions, which I worked on probably about 4 years ago and was published in the Journal of Quantitative Analysis of Sports, also mentioned in the Wall Street Journal.
How did you get the idea of looking into subs? Was there something that triggered that?
Yeah, I mean, probably reading the book Moneyball just sort of inspired me to investigate kind of applications in soccer for kind of mathematical modeling, you know, quantitative decision making. And so as a player, I always felt like, and I was always more of an attacking role, either as a midfielder or a forward. and felt like sometimes coming off the bench, it felt I was having more success in scoring. So I just wanted to look into this relationship of substitutes and kind of from an offensive standpoint, the kind of instant offense effect, but just to kind of, you know, go at it and just sort of go and explore through the data and see if there are any interesting patterns that came up.
And we'll get to some of the conclusions that you've drawn from that 2011 study. But first, I hope that one of them is that the 60th minute sub is absolutely ridiculous. You see so many coaches make the sub at the 60th minute because 60 minutes for some reason means something, and it clearly doesn't, right?
Well, I mean, that's not entirely true. I mean, I think maybe we err in that direction just because it's a round number. You know, it's representative of 2/3 of the game. It's a lot for 15 minutes in the second half. But you know, when I kind of looked at it and found significance kind of according to a particular sort of game state, that you know, it was close. You know, close to the 60th minute being a critical point. I mean, my study had it exactly at 58, but you know, a couple minutes here and there is not going to make a huge difference.
Now, I have to warn you, because I didn't come into this, and we may get into this, but Simon has a very old school, old man on the porch view of analytics. But let's move forward. Talk to us about the main conclusions from your paper and where it came out on adding substitutions, on how substitutions are used.
Well, I think that the main conclusion from the paper is that the most benefit from substitutions occurs when you're actually behind in the match. So I think that it's probably a couple of factors going on there. I mean, I think if you're behind in a match, probably wasn't the best performance, up with that starting 11 during the course of the time. So I think the idea here is that maybe managers are a bit reluctant to make subs, maybe trying to put too much faith into the starting 11 that they selected. So, you know, kind of based on the critical splits that I found that, you know, managers that kind of followed that particular pattern that I recommended were basically doubling their odds of success and kind of getting back into games after being behind.
And so in this now new study, when they talk about a fourth substitution, is that game quality based changing, is saying let's improve the product, or is it a health issue for players?
It's obviously just going to be speculative at this point because we don't have the evidence. But I think the rationale would be that it could benefit both areas. You know, that that maybe if there's a bit of quality lacking during that game from the starting 11. You can draw further into your depth to improve it. But I think over the period of time, being able to, you know, over the course of time, being able to rotate more players, that's going to, I think, be beneficial to have that additional guy to put in the rotation. And I think maybe in the long run, it kind of go back to the quality that if we have that fourth player who's also getting significant time, if he or she is going to be called into the starting 11 at some point, and that's just another opportunity to get experience coming off the bench that could prove valuable in the long run.
Now, have you seen some of your conclusions put into practice, perhaps with Toronto FC, perhaps with other groups that you've worked with, and have you noticed any results from it?
It's a good question, and kind of one of the things I'd like to do. It's hard, especially now that I've gotten into the consulting role, to kind of find the time to delve into these research questions. But yeah, I'd like to see if there has been any change in kind of what I would call a participation rate in that pattern. You know, one of the things I did within the study was to, you know, go and examine teams and see if there were certain teams or certain managers that were more likely to follow the rule. And it was kind of interesting because when I did that particular study and wanted to see, you know, kind of look at manager trends and following my proposed rule, you know, one of the biggest adopters was Jose Mourinho. And that was back at his time with Inter. And I think virtually every opportunity he had that season to do it, he did it. And, you know, the team had success as a result.
So help us again, if you can reiterate, what is the proposed rule that came out of your study in layman's terms?
Sure. So if you found yourself behind in the match, so let's say behind going into the second half, that if you could get that first sub in prior to the 58th minute, the second sub prior to the 73rd, then the third sub prior to the 79th, that you basically doubled your odds of improvement in the game state. So that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to go from behind and be guaranteed a tie or a win, but it was I define improvement as an improvement in goal differential, kind of from the starting point prior to that first sub to the end point by the end of 90 minutes.
And Professor Myers, ideally, if you were to put your theories into practice about when the ideal time is to make your subs, would you want data from that specific game to help educate you in that decision and making a recommendation? Is there data that you can get from a game that would influence how you would go about your subs for that specific match?
Well, I think kind of this is just very, very surfacey. I mean, it's just kind of looking, we're not really considering any other variables other than time and score state. So I think it's just, it's logical to think that there are going to be other factors that come into play as well. So, one of the things that'd be interesting to see is we're starting to kind of increase capabilities and the technologies of, wearable devices, and we're, able to kind of assess physical type of performance of the players and kind of analyzing, is there a certain point where we start to see a drop in performance? And yet, to be honest, I haven't seen enough of that data yet. But I think hypothetically, if that kind of data were made available during the game, that, maybe we could start to see patterns just like I was able to discover with purely looking at times, the substitution game. So, yeah, there's an opportunity there for sure.
Now, a lot of people are going to say this proposal that's coming out of the IFAB that they're going to vote on whether or not there should be a fourth substitution is there used to be none, then there was three, now there's four. Of when will it end? Is there any sort of thing you've seen in your research or anything that you've talked about with people of what an ideal number would be?
There's nothing in the research, at least, because, I kind of made a similar point before that we just don't have the empirical evidence. I would be one to just kind of have the philosophy that it would be better to have less limitations on the subs, but I do understand the other point of view, which is that, we want to have continuity at the same time and flow in a game. So there needs to be a balance, but I think where we are at this point and restricting to three is way too tight of a constraint. And I think it's just, I think opening the door to allow more will have those benefits that we talked about earlier.
And so, Professor Myers, I know you're not in the IFAB, but what would prevent the board that determines rules for soccer, what would dissuade them from saying, yes, let's do four subs?
It'd probably be the same kind of rationale as to, why there'd be resistance to goal line technology and anything that's kind of an advance, because we're maybe trying to protect the purity of the game and, we're worried about the slippery slope of what can happen once we do start opening this up to more. So I think it just kind of gets into this sort of the purest point of view of the sport. And, I always try to be moderate in these situations, but I think we need to respect what we find in research, opportunities that exist with technology. So it's good that we have the conversation and we put these things up to a vote. So I would just only hope that, they would look to accept the fourth sub and look to move forward.
Excellent. Professor Myers, this was a great conversation. We'd hope that we can maybe in the future have you back to maybe discuss some other analytics-related topics. It was a good conversation. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on. I enjoyed it.
That was Brett Myers, Assistant Professor of Operations and Management at the Villanova School of Business, also an analytics consultant for Toronto FC. And we have posted a link to his paper, that 2011 paper on substitutions in soccer that he referenced in that interview. It's on our page. It's mlssoccer.com/extra time. That topic sure to create a lot of discussion in our next mailbag on the next show, but the current mailbag is full as is. We'll get to that after the break.
V Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Hey, this is Bobby Wood from the U.S. National Team. You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
Back on Extra Time Radio, David Gonson, Simon Borg. And it's time for the mailbag segment. You're listening on MLSsoccer.com and SiriusXM Channel 94. David, but first, we're nearing the end of the show, and fans then, when the show's over, can sit down and put together their fantasy team. So let them know how to join the league.
Yeah, we finally got the code. We made the league. The number is 1183-524. Once again, that number is 1183-524. We already have some good teams in there. We already have some funny team names going. So make sure that you get your team in only 1 week
to the
season.
What's the one that stands out to you?
I couldn't remember.
I'll put you on the spot.
I think someone named...
That's, to me, one of the challenging parts of fantasy.
Is making
up with a
the
good
team name. My team name's terrible, so I have to
what
go back. I don't want to say it. I have to go back.
What do you mean you don't want to say it? That's the fun of joining the league, well, is because people know what your league is.
Exactly, so they'll see it when they join, because otherwise you don't get
is
to
it
see
obvious?
It.
Is it obvious? Will I know it's you?
No, you
so
won't.
Then what?
You will. Right.
Well,
you
next
will
show,
my new
next
one.
Show... You're going to give it to us.
And we are looking also for the prize.
Next show, you're going to give us the name.
Yeah, so interesting about that. So we're looking for the prize that what you guys Gosh. Want. And Andre from Montreal, who's a Borg supporter from Montreal, emailed us. He said the winner should get an MLS ball.
I didn't
ball.
Know those existed, by the yeah, way.
Neither did I. He wants an MLS ball that's signed by all the real-life players that constitute their team in the final week.
Wow,
that's expensive. That's a little bit hard to send a ball around the country and get everyone to sign it. So keep coming at us with ideas of what you guys want as your reward. But let's jump into your emails. And we got a great one here from Dan in Massachusetts. He's a fourth-generation American-Portuguese. So he was really interested by our interview with the professor last episode. And he said that what he finds most fascinating about Ronaldo is that he has a parent from the Azores, which is the islands, and a parent whose family is from Portugal, the mainland. And he said that those two don't get along very well, and that the people from the mainland talk down about people from the islands, and they call them peasants, and they call them simple. And that when Ronaldo came out of Madeira, which isn't the Azores, but is close to that, he was ridiculed. But the moment he became the Ronaldo that we know, he's the national icon. And they, when he originally came out, the professor had mentioned to us that people made fun of his accent. So he thought that was a really interesting...
Look, it mirrors my story in Malta. I'm from Gozo, which is the smaller island.
Okay.
The mainland is Malta. When I went to university in Malta, people made fun of my accent because we speak differently in Gozo than we do in Malta. We're considered peasants. And here I am now, the beacon of Maltese culture in the United States.
The beacon. Just shining bright like a light. Well, you as
yes, that's what a beacon is. Thank you, David.
You as a beacon decided to step up onto this show and so intelligently say, Elvis died of poop, which was...
poop problems.
Which was... No, that's like, not how you said it. It was eloquently put. So we got an email from a doctor.
It wasn't... Poop wasn't thrown at him.
No.
And he died.
We understand that. So we got an email from a doctor who's a fan of the show, and it's a lot of different...
how bad did I get?
Descriptions.
It? How off was
it? Well, what he said was Elvis was overweight, and he was also dealing with drug problems, so he was taking uppers and downers. So his heart was weak because of the uppers.
Okay.
And so basically his theory is that...
His theory? Or we don't know?
No, he doesn't know exactly. But he said, gun to my head, I suspect that he was straining while he was sitting on the toilet, as people tend to do, and it caused his heart to fail.
Right, because he was straining because he was backed up, which is my
which
point.
Which he said so. Was, regardless, Elvis was likely constipated and unable to expel his poop.
So
but the poop did not kill him. It was a contributing factor.
Yeah, well, but without the poop, then he wouldn't have the predicament that he was in.
No.
So I still consider myself accurate.
You consider yourself correct right now.
Correct.
Okay, I just want to know how your mind works. We brought up Rookie Hazing last show, and you were not a fan of the haircuts.
I would punch people who tried to make me do that stuff.
We got an email from someone who calls themselves Ritero. I think he's in the Vancouver area. He had a pleasure to interview Sam Adekube on the Vancouver Whitecaps during a friendly, and Adekube mentioned that his rookie year, he had to do the dishes. So he'd come in every day and had to do the dishes before training. Are
what
you
does that
okay
teach?
With that?
What does that teach? No, but I'd like to know, what does that teach?
I don't know.
Oh, do all the dishes. Big deal. Like, what do you teach them? I already have good values. So that's why I would really look down on anyone trying to teach me how to be a good anything. My values, I stand by them and move to the next question.
Well, I just want you to know his PS was, it's Okanagan. I think that you had trouble pronouncing the other campus.
I think we had to do it three times to probably get 2 out of 3, which is pretty good for the first time without having a guide.
Yeah, I'll take that.
Anyone else?
Not for now.
Come on, end on a stronger note.
You want us to end on a stronger note? I thought that was a pretty strong note. I will tell you this.
A pronunciation.
We got an email. We got an email in from San Antonio from Matthew Shattuck, who I emailed with, and he sent us his scoreboard.
Okay.
So he has one. He sent it to us. It's a PR.
He's calling
player
it scoreboard. He cannot call it a
scoreboard. Oh, you can't copyright it if you don't make one.
Well, no. Wait for my scoreboard. Believe me, it's coming.
So the gauntlet has been thrown down.
The scoreboard is coming. So is Andrew Wiebe, we think, on Monday's show. That's the next time we'll be here for Extra Time Radio. It's the first week of the MLS season leading into the first games of the MLS season.
I can taste it on my tongue.
You've been listening to Extra Time Radio on MLSsoccer.com, Sirius XM Channel 94. We'll see you Monday.